ॐ अजनति मिनन्दस्य जनजनसलकय चक्षुसमिलितञ्जेन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. श्रीचैतन्यमनुविष्टं स्तपितं जिनबुद्धले सायं प्रगदमायं ददति सपदन्तिकम्. वंशकपतुभ्यश्च कृपसिन्धुभैव च नित्यं पवनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. Reading from the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, just about in the middle of chapter 19. Now, in the past two chapters, there's been descriptions of different varshas, or divisions of more or less what we know as the earth planet, and how on these different divisions there are very heavenly places. Not, I guess it's not exactly the earth, but there are different heavenly tracts, and in these places there are different prominent individuals who are exalted personalities, very, very, very powerful and exalted. When we think of what an exalted person is, I think everyone will have their own concept according to what they value in life of what it means to be exalted. For a person who's a sportsman, could be an exalted person. His conception of an exalted person could be, I guess it depends on what sport he's into. Someone, a great marksman, could be considered an exalted person, or a person who's a great basketball player, or who can kick a ball so far, or can take a piece of wood and bang a little teeny ball into a little hole, you know, a couple of hundred meters away. So when you see that, when someone who thinks that that's really what the importance of life is, he'll see that person, when he sees him, oh, please, can I have your autograph? Or something like that. And other people will see movie stars or musicians or very, very wealthy people or very, very people with well-developed muscles, see them as exalted personalities. But in the Vedic culture, who is seen as an exalted personality? Well, those who are seen as exalted are those who are realized on the level of the eternal. They understand who they are, the eternal aspect of themselves, who they truly are, and they understand who the supreme eternal is, who God is. So those personalities, there's different levels of exaltation also even with those personalities. But yet, that is the standard in the Vedic culture of who is exalted, who is truly elevated, who is truly perfect in the field of fields, so to speak. Is a person who knows God. He is considered an exalted personality. And one thinks about it, that's obviously what makes one truly exalted, or it's superior than other exaltations. Why? Because that is eternal. Well, if we're exalted physically, how long will our exaltation last? At most, the length of the body. And if we have exalted knowledge in bioengineering or some type of nuclear chemistry or something like that, how long will that exaltation last? Only as long as we're in this body, as long as the intelligence is connected to the body. When the body dies, we leave all that behind. But that which is gained eternally is considered truly gained in the Vedic culture. And what is that? realization about ourselves, the true nature of ourselves, the true nature of God, and the relationship between the tiny soul and the Supreme Lord. That is actually the possession of the soul. That is eternal gain. And therefore, because it's eternal, it has greater value than things that are temporary. And that stands to reason. If someone would say you can be a millionaire or a billionaire for an eighth of a second, it's not even worth the trouble saying yes. It would be fun because it would be over by the time you finish the sentence. So that benefits, those benefits that have longer duration are more beneficial than those who have lesser duration. And the benefits that accrue to us that are eternal have the most value. And those who have achieved eternal benefit, eternal knowledge, eternal realization, because the benefits are eternal, as well as the knowledge being eternal, they're considered truly exalted. So these exalted personalities, they shared their realizations of the Supreme with us by, in the Bhagavatam, by us being able to hear their prayers. And the nature of the particular aspect of the Supreme Lord that they were glorifying was very much in the sense of Him being the protector, the maintainer, the all-powerful. That we are not independent. Although, as we go about our day, we don't like to think of ourselves as dependent, but actually we are completely dependent. We are tiny, we are insignificant. But instead of wishing to live in that consciousness, that ego, that identity, we prefer to live in a illusory consciousness, false ego, false identity, and try to build up more and more of who we are, more conceptions of who we are. But we're going to lose every one of those conceptions, everything from that I'm strong and powerful and intelligent, all those exaltations that we value in others, we try to achieve for ourselves, but as long as they are based on not what is truly, eternally us, we will lose them in time. But yet, we identify with those things. I'm a house owner. I have a great, powerful dog. I have a wonderful, shiny, red Porsche car. And we identify with these things. And this way we build up a false ego or a false identity of who we are. I'm knowledgeable, I'm learned, I'm strong, I'm beautiful, I'm wealthy, I have defeated this one likes me, this one is I don't like, I'm good at this, I know this skill. And we build up all these, the Sanskrit word is upadis. More or less that means layers upon our actual identity. Falsity built upon truth. That we're not even aware of who we are. So who are we? We are very tiny. We are very insignificant. But yet we're eternal, and that part we forget, but rather we try to build up. So these personalities, these exalted personalities expressed that who is great? That is God. And we are dependent on Him. We are dependent on Him. He is the actual protector. Because if we're going to advance spiritually, if we're going to become devotees of God, devoted to God. A devotee is one who is devoted. A bhakta in Sanskrit is one who has bhakti. A devotee has devotion. Then we have to know the qualities of the Supreme Lord that make Him worthy of taking shelter. If we want to take shelter of Him, but we have to know and trust His power, His potency, that He can actually protect us. We have to know His power to know that He can protect us. Before we can have an intimate relationship with Him, we have to know these aspects of the Supreme Lord. So that the personalities and the other vashas or divisions that we heard of before, these exalted personalities, exalted on the spiritual line, they spoke about how this Lord was so powerful and that He's the controller of the illusory energy. He's the control of all, the ultimate control of all the energies of this world. And the illusory energy. That means that if He wishes to, that the curtain of the illusory energy is removed from us, because He's the controller of the illusory energy, then it will be moved. And otherwise, daivyesh shagunamayi mama maya diratyaya. By our own, we cannot remove the power of illusion, maya. We cannot. It is more powerful than us. Daivyesha. This is daivy. It is divinely inspired. It's empowered. It is empowered by the Lord Himself. Illusion is empowered by the Lord Himself. So therefore we cannot break out by our own power. So in the particular prayers that we're going to hear now, in a different varsha, we're going to hear, and this is a somewhat of a different style prayers, and possibly in the next 2 days we'll be able to complete this remaining section of the 19th chapter. There's several purports that are important. Now what these prayers discuss is a place called Bharatvarsh, which we can say in our everyday terms is India. And this Bharatvarsha is considered very special. Very special. India is very special. What is the speciality of India? And especially a birth in India. One could say that it has more chaos per square inch than any other place that you've been to. If you've been there, you know what I mean. But that is not the wonder, the glory that is India, Bharatvarsha. That is something layered over that which is wonderful there. So we're going to hear about what is wonderful about India and birth in India. So here we'll start with reading text 16. In the tract of land known as Bharatvarsha, as in Ilavritta Varsha, that was one of the other Varshas or divisions that we heard about previously. In Bharatvarsha, there are many mountains and rivers. Some of the mountains are known as Malaya, Mangalaprastha, Mainaka, Trikuta, Rishabha, Kutaka, Kolaka, Saya, Devagiri, Rishamukha, Srishaila, Venkata, Mahendra, Varidhara, Vindhya, Shuktiman, Rikshagiri, Pariyatra, Drona, Chitrakut, Govardhan, Raivataka, Kakuba, Nila, Gomukha. Anyone familiar with some of these names? Where is Vindhya? The Vindhya Hills, is that north?
Down, you get to
Orissa,
right? Before you go past the
Vindhya. Chitrakoot, that's the forest Chitrakoot. There's a hill or mountain Chitrakoot too. Do you know of it? Now we know of Govardhan Hill, mountain in Vrindavan. Raivataka, I think that's on the western side, I think. Nila, Gomukh. No, that's not Gomukh. It's Gokamukha. I don't know what Gokamukha is. No, I know what Gomukh is. Where, you know where that is? No.
Kutaka is in Karnataka.
It's Karnataka.
In Karnataka.
Ah.
And Rishabdev.
Rishabdev. So these are all famous for. And Drona is a hill. I know that. Beside these, there are many other hills with many large and small rivers flowing from their slopes. Two of the rivers, the Brahmaputra and the Shona, are called nadas, or main rivers. These are other great rivers that are very prominent. Chandravasha, Tamrapani, Avatoda, Kritamala, Vaihayasi, Kaveri, Veni, Payasvini, Sharkavarta, Tungabhadra, these are all different rivers in Bharatvarsha. Krishnavenya, Brahmarata, Rati, Godavari, Nirvindya, Payushni, Tapi, Reva, Surasa, Narmada, Charmanvati, Mahanadi, Veda Smriti, Rishikulya, Trishamya, Kaushika, Mandakini, Yamuna, Saraswati, Drishavati, Gomati, Sarayu, Rodasvati, Saptavati, Shushoma, Shatadru, Chandrabhaga, Marudridha, Vitasta, Asikni, and Vishwa. The inhabitants of Bharadvarsha are purified because they always remember these rivers. Sometimes they chant the names of these rivers as mantras. So there are mantras that have these names. There's one, what's that one? When in purifying the water, making the Achman?
What is
it? Do you say that one? Yeah. So by these rivers have a certain potency, and by remembering them, or chanting mantras, it evokes that potency. And one is purified. The rivers themselves are purifying. They are holy rivers for one reason or another. If anyone has ever bathed in a holy river, it's clear. It's not ordinary. Not that we want to criticize the Swan River or anything like that. So in this way, sometimes they chant the names of these rivers as mantras. Sometimes they go directly to the rivers to touch them and bathe in them. Thus the inhabitants of Bharadvarsha become purified. Prabhupada's very short purport to this verse. All these rivers are transcendental. They're holy. Therefore, one can be purified by remembering them, touching them, or bathing in them. This practice is still going on. The people, so heard of something about the mountains were named in Bharadvarsha, and then the rivers, and now something of the people. The people who take birth in this tract of land are divided according to the qualities of material nature. The modes of goodness, sattva-gun, passion, rajagun, and ignorance, tamagun. These are the three dominating forces that dominate individuals. So in Bharadvarsha, some of them take birth, some people take birth as exalted personalities. Some are ordinary human beings, and some are extremely abominable. For in Bharadvarsha, one takes birth exactly according to one's past karma. It is simpler in one sense, the births in Bharadvarsha. And that's what was known as the caste system, that people took birth exactly according, had a very specific nature. In the West, and as time progresses and as this culture is lost, then we could turn the volume down a bit. It's quite overbearing. Thank you. So in the West, we can see that people have very, very mixed natures. That they could be, where I'm from, in New York, you really see this, that everyone in New York, regardless of whether they collect the garbage or no matter what they do, everyone is thinks they're a philosopher. Everyone is a philosopher. So sometimes the different natures are conflicting within us. Different aspects in our nature conflict within us. And it becomes confusing, in a sense. This is in contemporary society, this is what happens. People have very conflicting natures. They can have a philosophical mind and yet be, on the other hand, degraded. One can have strength and power and have a tendency to want to rule, but not want to protect the people that he's ruling, want to exploit them. So these are different aspects of the nature, of one's nature. So in the Vedic culture, people's nature was divided more simply and strictly. There were people who were strong and powerful, and they would rule. But they had a particular character that went along with those mental characteristics that allowed them to rule in a way that gave protection. And also these same people respected the intellectuals. They didn't try to rule or control the intellectuals, the Brahminical class. The Brahminical class, they were very, very detached. They were very moral, they were intellectual, they were learned, and they had a transcendental objective. They were spiritualists, not materialists. They were detached, they were touched very prominently by the mode of goodness. They weren't greedy. They didn't long for power. And they gave their knowledge freely. And then there were the administrators, the warriors, the politicians who respected those kind of people and took direction from them on which way to rule for a spiritual purpose. And then there were the business people, the vaishyas, mercantile people. They had their degree of culture too. And then there were the workers, the sujas. But now, in this age, everyone is mixed, have all these different parts and mixed, and one part wants to do one thing, and another part has this, and another part has degraded characteristics, and then there's an exalted side, and it's very confusing, and because it's confusing, it's like a horse and carriage that are going in four or five or six different directions all at the same time. You end up being pulled apart. And not making any progress. Because when one side of us is satisfied, another side is dissatisfied and longing for gratification. So, in Bharatvarsha, the birth, especially in times gone by, was simpler. It was simpler. And even you see this nowadays, in India, it's simpler. There are very, very good people. When you see a cultured person, their qualities are very, very fine. Their character is very fine. And when you see someone who's horrible, they are thoroughly horrible. So in Bharatvarsha, some of them are born as exalted personalities. Some are ordinary human beings and some are extremely abominable. For in Bharatvarsha, one takes birth exactly according to one's past karma. If one's position is ascertained by a bona fide spiritual master, and one is properly trained to engage in the service of the Lord, of Lord Vishnu according to the four social divisions, Brahmins, Kshatriya, Vaishyas, and Sudras, and the four spiritual divisions, Brahmacharya, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, and Sannyas, one's life becomes perfect. The idea is that whatever our nature is, whether it's exalted or midway or degraded, still with the proper engagement and the proper guidance, we can gradually make progress. And that's what everyone's mission in life is, really, is to make progress, to move forward spiritually. We might not be able to realize, become fully realized, exalted personalities, although there are methodologies that anyone can actually become like that, but at least we should use our life responsibly and move forward spiritually and not waste the gift of human life. So that's actually the message of the Vedic culture to the world. The basic message is that one human birth is special. Trap adruvam artadam. It has a special wealth that can be gained. And that is to use human life, use the intelligence, the discrimination afforded to our lives to progress spiritually. Don't use the intelligence just to enjoy, to become a sophisticated animal. So this Varnashrama system is meant to allow and to encourage and ensure that the people use their lives properly, spiritually, properly, going forward, not backwards, forward, progressive. So Prabhupada, we'll read a bit of Prabhupada's purport here. No one nowadays is being trained to act according to the principles of Varnashrama Dharma. And thus people are becoming increasingly degraded. Instead of going forward, people are going in the opposite direction, degraded, and are heading in the direction of animal life. The real aim of life is liberation. But unfortunately, the opportunity for liberation is being denied to people in general, and therefore their human lives are being spoiled. The purpose of life is not to accumulate, to add more and more layers onto the soul, to enjoy animal life. It's to become free, free from bondage, free from the entrapments. And that's called liberation, the Varnashrama system that we just spoke on very, very briefly and basically is meant for that. The Krishna consciousness movement, however, is being propagated all over the world to reestablish the Varnashrama system and thus save human society from gliding down to hellish life. So what is Varnashrama's purpose? Text 20. After many, many births, when the results of one's pious activities mature, one gets an opportunity to associate with pure devotees. In other words, as one acts in Varnashrama, one becomes more advanced, one becomes more subtle, one's consciousness becomes more subtle, less gross. One's values are different. So then, one becomes purified. So after many, many births, this is the Varnashrama system, many births, when the results of one's pious activities matures, when one acts properly and one's consciousness becomes more subtle, then what happens? One gets an opportunity to associate with pure devotees. Then, by that association, one is able to cut the knot of bondage to ignorance, the knot of bondage to ignorance which bound him because of varied fruit of activity. So many desires sit in our heart, and according to our consciousness we will have one type of desire or another. If we have a gross type of consciousness, we will desire gross type of things. There's some people who walk around and their desire is to kill people, beat people, rob people. So average people will recognize that as gross or inappropriate, improper. But there are so many different levels of this grossness. People whose desire is to kill animals just to eat them. Why do you want to eat animals? Because it tastes good. I like it. So how would you like it if someone thought that your arm tasted good, or your ears tasted good, or your something like that, or your spare ribs were very spare? You might not think so, but this is very gross type of enjoyment. The enjoyment centered on meat-eating, illicit sex, gambling, intoxication, very, very, very gross, very impious and gross. And that binds us. These type of gross enjoyments binds us to fruitive work and more further births in the material world. So when one's consciousness becomes more pious, one's desires change. And then one can appreciate what the actual purpose of life is, religiosity. As one becomes more pious, one becomes more religious. One wants to do good for others. One feels compassion to see the pain of others. What to speak of causing others pain, just to see someone in pain, one's own heart breaks. That's compassion. Subtlety of consciousness. Piety. But yet, it's not perfection. But when one Yesham tantagata papam jananam punyakam, one is pious, that attracts that which acts as the key to the door of liberation. Mahat sevam dwaram ahor vamukte. One attracts a pure devotee by Krishna's grace. Brahmanda brahmate konya bhagyavan jeev Guru Krishna prasari by bhakti lata vij. One attracts by some piety, one attracts the attention or purity of a pure soul, and then one has subtlety of consciousness. One will be able to appreciate what he is capable of giving. So Vanashrama makes one pious, and then that allows one to gain the association of a pure devotee, which will open the door to the spiritual world. So as a result of associating with devotees, one gradually renders service to Lord Vasudev, to God. Vasudev means the all-pervading Lord, who is transcendental, free from attachment to the material world, beyond the mind and words, and independent of everything else. That bhakti yoga, devotional service to Lord Vasudeva, is the real path of liberation. So gradually, this is describing the natural system of governance, cultural system in Bharatvarsha, is this Vanashrama system, which leads to pure devotional service, bhakti yoga, which brings one ultimately to the lotus feet of Govinda and Goloka Vrindavan. And again, this Vanashrama cultural system, societal organizational system, is a dividing society, so at least everyone will move forward in their spiritual life. We'll read some of Prabhupada's purport. In the material world, in the bodily concept of life, everyone is working in the wrong direction. Bodily concept of life means working in the wrong direction. What is bodily concept of life? It's a phrase that we use all the time. What does it mean, the bodily concept of life? Yeah, it means that when we have when we think of who I am, because everyone has a concept of who I am. I exist, I think, therefore I am. But what am I? Who am I? So when a person's concept of self-concept of who I am, who do we think of when we think of who I am? We look at, usually if it's a picture, I think I'm this person, you know, who looks back at me when I look in the mirror. That's who I am. That's called, when we think, when our concept of ourself, Our self-identification is of the body. When our self-concept is the body, that's called the bodily concept of life. And if we're in the bodily concept of life, if we think we are the body, how will we naturally act? If I think I'm the body, I'll actually act to give my, naturally act to give my body pleasure. If my primary identification is of my country, or say if it's, we'll take one step more basic than that, of my family. If I really identify myself as a member of a particular family, then our duty, our activities will be all centered around serving the family. If we think of I am the body, if that's our main concept, and nowadays everyone is very individualistic, thinking only in terms of me. Previously people thought in terms of my family, my community, my race, my nation, and therefore they felt very altruistic and very, very proud of their country and service to their country and service to their family. But it's all based on the bodily concept of life. Now, how our life would change if we saw ourselves as eternal, if our concept of life was not as the body, but as an eternal soul, then naturally, as when we think we're the body, we naturally serve the senses or our family or our country or our community or our caste or something like that. If we thought we were, if we understood and thought we had a concept of life as that I'm Krishna's servant, I'm eternal, then naturally we'd want to serve Krishna. So if we have the bodily concept of life, everyone works in the wrong direction. Not towards spiritual progress, but towards material entanglement. When one becomes Brahma-bhuta, spiritually realized, on the other hand, one understands that he is not the body, and that working in the bodily concept of life is useless and misdirected. Why useless? Because if we're working our whole life for something that's so temporary, we're misusing the opportunity, the chance offered by human life, by the intelligence that human life affords. So it's useless, it's wasted, misdirected. Our energy is misdirected in that way. So then if one's on the Brahma-bhuta platform, knowing that he's a soul, then, Prabhupada explains, his devotional service begins. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Brahma-bhuta prasanatma. One who is thus transcendentally situated realizes the Supreme Brahman. When he's out of the physical, bodily concept of life, he can realize the Supreme Brahman. And what is the result of that? He becomes joyful. He never laments. Nasochati nakanchati. He never laments or desires to have anything material. He is equally disposed to every living entity, saveshu bhuteshu, and in that state he attains pure devotional service to me. So pure devotional service begins when one gives up the bodily concept of life and understands that he is an eternal servant of Krishna. That's his sarup, jivera sarup hoy, Krishna nityadas, that's his actual identity. Devotional service is actual liberation. Freedom. When one is attracted by the beauty of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and his mind is always engaged at the Lord's lotus feet, he is no longer interested in subjects that do not help him in self-realization. In other words, he loses all attraction for material activities. It's a matter of taste. It's a matter of subtlety or grossness of consciousness. If we have subtle consciousness, Krishna consciousness, spiritual consciousness, then we lose the gross tastes that are natural when one has gross consciousness. If one has subtle consciousness and you say, we have some nice food for you, some nice roasted flesh for you to eat, and you see other people, you know, going, what do you call it? Mackers? going bonkers at Macca's or something, you know, just putting that seared flesh down their gullet, pushing it through, and then drinking alcohol to digest it, and everything, and then smoking cigarettes, and smoking this and that, and cigars, this horrible smoke. And other people are thinking, this is heaven. This is heaven. Just like a pig in India, in Vrindavan, sometimes you'll see the pigs in the heat of the summer. They're in the sewers. They have open sewers. So a pig will be in the sewer, just wallowing with all the horrible sewage. And he's thinking, wow, the greatest. And if, because his consciousness is so much grosser than yours. He has a pig consciousness. When you say you're really a pig to someone, you're not complimenting them. It means gross. So similarly, when one's subtle consciousness becomes subtle, the pleasures of gross consciousness are no longer appealing because he has most subtle pleasures. So he loses, as Prabhupada says. In other words, he loses all attraction for material activities because they're gross. Text 21. Since the human form of life is the sublime position for spiritual realization, all the demigods in heaven speak in this way. So higher people in the more pleasurable situation, the demigods in the heavenly planets, not in the spiritual world, but who have heavenly delights, this is how they think. How wonderful it is for these human beings to have been born in the land of Bharatvarsha. They must have executed pious acts of austerity in the past, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself must have been pleased with them. Otherwise, how could they engage in devotional service in so many ways? We demigods can only aspire to achieve human births in Bharatvarsha to execute devotional service. But these humans are already engaged there. In other words, I'll read Prabhupada's purport. These facts are further explained in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Bharat bhumite hoila manushya janmayar janma sartaka kari kara para upakar. One who has taken his birth as a human being in the land of Bharatvarsh, India, should make his life successful and work for the benefit of all other people. There are many facilities in India at Bharatvarsha for executing devotional service. In Bharatvarsha, all the acharyas contributed their experience. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu personally appeared to teach the people of Bharatvarsha how to progress in spiritual life and be fixed in devotional service to the Lord. From all points of view, Bharatvarsha is the special land where one can very easily understand the process of devotional service and adopt it to make his life successful. If one makes his life successful in devotional service, and then preaches devotional service in other parts of the world, people throughout the world will actually benefit. So this is something that Prabhupada and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and here in the Bhagavatam, is saying in a somewhat less direct way. But there is a special facility offered by taking birth in Bharatvarsha. One, there is a particular mentality that one acquires by that birth. And second, there is a facility that the land nurtures one with. And that is such things as the acharyas, the great, great spiritual teachers of India. One naturally, as one grows up, one naturally assimilates these teachings. Just like if you're born in Australia or the United States, you naturally grow up knowing about Santa Claus. In Australia, you'll naturally know about Ned Kelly. It's just part of the culture. Or if you grow up in the United States, there's a whole mystique about the Wild West. and cowboys and Indians, but different kinds of cowboys than Vrindavan cowboys, and different kinds of Indians also. But it's part of the culture. You naturally have a feel for this. Santa Claus, ho, ho, ho. Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer. And Christmas trees and all that. It's just and New Year's and the different holidays that come with a particular culture and a birth in a country. So in India, the culture is so, it has a particular spiritual tinge to it. The acharyas, that naturally one is born understanding something about Krishna, something about the spiritual concept that one is not the body, that one is eternal. One naturally imbibes and assimilates this just by being born there. One naturally trusts that if I bathe in this particular river, I'll be purified. One naturally trusts that food offered to the deities is prasadam, mercy, and if I eat it, I'll be purified. Last time I was in India, there was this one Indian man who was somehow or another, I was in a situation that he was giving me trouble about that I was chanting. And then when I was leaving that situation, I took out some mahaprasadam from Jagannath Puri. And he was basically an atheist by his belief. And then I took out some prasadam from Jagannath Puri and I gave it to him. And he put out his hands and went, "Oh my God." And he took it. And he was like completely thrilled to get this spiritual food. It was so contradictory in one sense. On one hand, there was an acquired, completely atheistical belief system that intellectually and mentally he was fully immersed in. But on the other hand, there was this complete cultural conditioning that had completely overwon his heart. That is a benefit of a birth in Bharadvaja. Even the atheists, they're spiritual in that sense. It's like being born in a good family. You can't get away from your cultural, the etiquettes, the habits, the spiritual beliefs that you've imbibed when you were young. So what Prabhupada is suggesting, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is suggesting that it's a facility. That type of a birth is a facility, and if one takes advantage of that facility, one can achieve perfection himself, and then one can help others. And I would like to just read one more verse, because if I do so, then there's more chance of us being able to finish our proper up to the speed and finish what we had to finish tomorrow. So there's one more verse. Thank you very much for your patience. We'll try it a little further. It's hard to sit for such a long period of time, especially at the end of the day. So thank you very much for your concerted efforts. So, text 22. The demigods continued. After performing the very difficult tasks of executing Vedic ritualistic sacrifices, undergoing austerities, observing vows, and giving charity, the demigods are saying, "We have achieved this position as inhabitants of the heavenly planets. But what is the value of this achievement? Here we are certainly very engaged in material sense gratification, and therefore we can hardly remember the lotus feet of Lord Narayan, the Lord. Indeed, because of our excessive sense gratification, we have almost forgotten his lotus feet." We forget God when we're in a situation that is materially very opulent. There's a tendency just to lean back and enjoy. And then one forgets God. And one is also forgetting that this situation, regardless of how wonderful it is, it by definition must be temporary. It must be temporary, but we want to enjoy it to the fullest and squeeze every bit of pleasure out of it, and therefore we don't want to think it's temporary, and therefore we're practically speaking become so overwhelmed by the material sensual pleasures that we forget that there's any reason to even think about God, that we're going to die and that and what's going to happen next, and that we're actually eternally servants of God. We completely forget. We become absorbed, saturated with the material pleasure. So the demigods are in that situation. They're so materially satisfied that they tend to forget God, and thereby they cut themselves off from a more subtle, more wonderful, more an eternal, the eternal pleasures, the actual pleasures of the soul. So therefore they're saying that a birth in Bharadvaja is superior to this type of birth where there's more pleasure that we're experiencing, because in this situation, saturated by so much material pleasure, we tend to forget eternal life, eternal blissful life in the spiritual world, and therefore that it, so the pleasure becomes our, the cause of our misfortune. Usually people think of fortune and misfortune simply in terms of what material facilities we can enjoy or be miserable in. This is giving a completely different perspective, the demigod saying that we're not fortunate. When we see someone who's very wealthy or powerful or beautiful or intelligent, we think, oh, they're so fortunate. But the demigods who have those things are saying that is not actual fortune. But being birthed in Bharadvaja, which is not so materially pleasurable, but it offers a spiritual chance, that is fortunate. So I'll quickly read this purport. People in the land of Bharadvaja generally follow the Vedic principles and consequently perform great sacrifices by which they can be elevated to the heavenly planets. However, what is the use of such great attainment? What is the use of material pleasure? As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Chine Punye Martyalokam Vashanti. After the results of one's sacrifices, charity, and other pious activities expire, one must return to the lower planetary systems and again feel the pangs of birth and death. However, one who becomes Krishna conscious can go back to Krishna, yanti mad yajyo pimam. Therefore, the demigods even regret having been elevated to the higher planetary systems. The denizens of the heavenly planets regret that they could not take full advantage of being born in the land of Bharadvaja. Instead, they became captivated by a higher standard of sense gratification. And therefore, they forgot the lotus feet of Lord Narayan at the time of death. The conclusion is that one who has taken birth in the land of Bharadvaja must follow the instructions given personally by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, yad gatva navavartante tadhamam paramam mama. One should try to return home back to Godhead, to the Vaikuntha planets, or to the topmost Vaikuntha planet, Golok Vrindavan, to live eternally in full blissful life in the company of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. I'd ask for questions, but it's already too late, so forget it. Tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll continue if Krishna allows, and then let's see if we have time for questions then. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.